If I was Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Iraqi government forces swept into the Kurdish-held city of Kirkuk Monday, capturing the governor's office, according to key military sites in an oil field. In a lightning flash strike, Baghdad's U.S. trained troops entered the northern city and, on the orders from the Iraqi prime minister, raised flags, Iraqi flags, in place of Kurdish banners. The move came less than a day after launching the operation in response to last month's Kurdish vote for independence that the central government declared was illegal. The death toll in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, has topped 300 as rescue teams continue to search for survivors from a massive explosion blamed on Islamist militants. The government says 429 injured people have been taken to local hospitals, and key death toll is likely to rise. More than 30 badly wounded patients were flown to Turkey on Monday for treatment, including a VOA Somali reporter. There has been no claim of responsibility, but Somali government officials and terrorism experts strongly believe that al-Shabaab militants were behind the explosion. U.S. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who was held by the Taliban insurgents in Afghanistan for 5 years before being freed in a prisoner swap, has pleaded guilty Monday to charges that he endangered comrades by walking off his post. At a court-martial hearing in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, Bergdahl pleaded guilty to charges of desertion and misbehavior before the enemy. The latter carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. He was captured by the Taliban shortly after he left his remote post in 2009, prompting an extensive manhunt. He's from Idaho and previously explained his action, saying he merely intended to cause alarm. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump says his decision not to recertify Iran's compliance with the Iran nuclear deal could lead to its total termination. It's a very real possibility, Mr. Trump said Monday, as he began a meeting with his cabinet at the White House. But Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, speaking to VOA, says the international community is very concerned with the direction the president is taking.
Europeans remain very committed to this deal. They believe that it is truly a triumph of diplomacy, and they're absolutely abhorred that not only is President Trump undermining the Paris Agreement, he left UNESCO, he's fiddling with NATO, and now he's also doing this. They're seeing a pattern in which the President of the United States is essentially targeting almost all international agreements and institutions that constitute the very bedrock of the current international system.
Mr. Trump defended the decision Monday, saying he felt strongly that something has to be done about a deal that has railed against both candidate and president, even though he twice recertified the agreement in the first months of his presidency. All entries submitted to the U.S. Diversity Immigrant Visa Program, also known as the Green Card Lottery, between October 3rd and 10th have been lost due to a technical glitch. Individuals who submitted applications during these dates are directed to reapply. State Department will be sending automated email notifications to each entrant who applied in early October. Venezuela's opposition coalition is rejecting the results of Sunday's gubernatorial elections, in which the ruling Socialist Party won at least 17 of the country's 23 states. The opposition, which has been predicted to take at least half the states, won just 5 states while the votes were still being counted in eastern Bolivar State, where still being counted on Monday. U.S. President Donald Trump is heading to 5 Asian countries early next month, looking to ramp up pressure against North Korea's nuclear weapons development, but also promote American economic interests in the region.
Well, I'll be going, as you know, to South Korea, to China, to Japan, to Vietnam for the summit. We have a big economic summit there. I may be going to the Philippines also. We've been invited to the Philippines. I may be going to the Philippines. And I look forward to all of them. We haven't set the details.
The trip runs from November 3rd through 14th. Mr. Trump has marshaled international support at the United Nations for economic sanctions against North Korea in an effort to deprive Pyongyang of export money to fund its nuclear weapons program. But the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, has continued the nuclear and ballistic missile test. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The governor of Nigeria's Imo State is defending his decision to honor South African President Jacob Zuma with a giant bronze statue.
President Jacob Zuma is not only the honoree. The Ghanaian president also received the same award 2 weeks ago. So it's part of the honors of Imo State government, you know, to honor deserving Nigerians and Africans who have excelled in various endeavors.
Iberi Nzewuji is a special assistant to Imo State Governor Rochas Okorocha. The death toll in last weekend's explosion in Somalia's capital has risen to more than 300. And Sierra Leone's opposition SLPP has chosen former military leader Julius Maada Bio as its candidate for the 2018 presidential election.
We are talking about a candidate that has served this country in a very difficult and defining moment and was able to make a very responsible decision for this country. And he initiated the peace process in this country, and he also spearheaded the democratic transition from military rule to civilian rule.
Laiha Lawrence Lima is the National Publicity Secretary of the Sierra Leone People's Party. Former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar has again refused to meet with a delegation from the National Dialogue Steering Committee. Small-scale farmers in Kenya turned to mechanized agriculture, and a website was launched this month highlighting literary contributions from black writers in Portuguese Africa. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The governor of Nigeria's Imo State, Rochas Okorocha, has come under criticism for honoring South African President Jacob Zuma over the weekend with a giant bronze statue, a chieftaincy title, and a road named after Mr. Zuma. But Nigerians have been expressing outrage on social media for honoring the embattled South African president who, they say, faces a slew of corruption charges in South Africa. Dr. Iberi Nzewuji is special assistant for electronic media to Governor Okorocha. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that the award given to President Zuma is part of recognition given by the Imo State government to deserving Nigerians and Africans who have excelled in various endeavors.
President Jacob Zuma is not only the honoree. The Ghanaian president also received the same award 2 weeks ago. So it's part of the honors of Imo State government, you know, to honor deserving Nigerians and Africans who have excelled in various endeavors. And each one of them has a statue at the Hall of Fame in Imo State. Two, it's also part of the private visit of Jacob Zuma. One, to identify with the foundation of the governor, who has an educational foundation. So they came to exchange ideas and minds on it. And also he led South African businessmen to Imo on various discussions, you know, to develop an industrial park in the state and also to help to develop an international cargo airport in Imo State.
On social media platforms, Nigerians have been expressing displeasure, saying that the honor made Nigerians a laughingstock, particularly when Jacob Zuma faces a slew of allegations or corruption charges back home. How do you respond to such criticisms?
People should remember that also Jacob Zuma was a freedom fighter. Two, Jacob Zuma also has an education foundation that he's been supporting for a long time. So if somebody can be, you know, seen to be convicted already before a law court.
Critics are asking what Zuma has done for the people of Imo and by and large Nigeria, particularly when Nigerians face xenophobic attacks, and that the honor basically is an affront to not only Nigerians but to Africans. What do you say to such criticisms from Nigerians?
We are a government and we value the lives of Nigerians anywhere and everywhere they are. On bilateral talks on this issue of xenophobic attacks by South Africans, the two governments, the government of Nigeria and the government of South Africa, have been meeting over the years addressing this issue. And Jacob Zuma, as the leader of their government, has done a lot, you know, with their Nigerian counterparts at the federal level, you know, to address these issues. The cooperation of South Africa, you know, like, hasn't been questioned. It's an unfortunate thing that is happening, yes, in Africa between brothers, but that has been addressed by the two nations.
Lanre Suraj, the chairman of the Civil Society Network Against Corruption, has called on the Nigerian government to call Governor Okorocha to order And his group is demanding an apology from the governor for promoting what he called President Zuma, who has been adjudged to be a corrupt leader by the Southern African judiciary, and for embarrassing Nigerians. How do you respond to such?
I think, you know, it is left for the South African courts, you know, to decide, you know, whether Jacob Zuma is corrupt or not. But this man is still functioning as a president. This man is still functioning as a head of a government, and this man has a foundation. And he came here on those two bases, as a head of a government who can still do business, and two, you know, to exchange ideas and partnership with another foundation who is doing a similar thing he's doing in Africa, educational scholarships. And that's what happened. He came from Zambia on official functions and duties, and I guess he's heading to Congo too. So will they ostracize this man until before he's convicted?
Dr. Iberi Unzewuji is the Special Assistant for Electronic Media to Governor Roy Charles Okorocha of Nigeria's Imo State. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Owerri. The opposition Sierra Leone People's Party, SLPP, has chosen former military leader Julius Mada Bio as its candidate for the country's 2018 presidential election. Bio challenged President Ernest Bai Koroma in the 2012 election and was defeated. This time, he will be running against current Foreign Minister Samura Kamara, who was elected Sunday by the ruling All People's Congress Party to succeed President Ernest Bai Koroma. Mada Bio's election comes at a time that some say the SLPP has been battling divisions and infighting. Lahai Lawrence Lema, National Publicity Secretary of the SLPP, says the party has corrected the lapses of 2012. He says Mada Bio was elected by a unified party that is ready to win in 2018.
What we did it in compliance with the general direction of the SLPP National Constitution. Retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio scored 475 votes out of 647 votes. So retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio, who scored the highest votes, was declared the winner and the flag bearer of the Sierra Leone People's Party to take the party to the 2018 elections. What is also brilliant to showcase our unity and our democracy was the fact that all other aspirants who lost to retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio congratulated him, and retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio thanked them for showing themselves as true patriots and Democrats, and we all stood together as one country, one people, and celebrated the victory.
Your candidate now, Julius Mada Bio, he ran again in 2012, and your party was defeated. So by electing him, what do you think are your chances against the APC in 2018?
The elections in 2012 was a controversial one, though, of which the party and retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio himself have said times without number that we accepted that result in the interest of peace. What is different from the 2012 to now is that President Koroma, who was an incumbent president who contested with retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio, is no longer running. And the lapses at perhaps in the 2012 elections have been corrected. And the pattern of voting, and at the same time the candidate the APC has presented also to the nation, it clearly gives the way for retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio to win the 2018 elections at the first ballot.
So what do you say to your critics, particularly from the APC, who say that your party, the SLPP, has been wounded with divisions and infighting? And with that, they don't think that you are ready for prime time.
One would want to recall that, yes, initially we had about more than 10 people who we are intending to vie for the flagship of the party. But as we got along the line, we are meeting as a party and we are able to solve our internal problems to a point that as we got close to the conference itself, we are left with only 5 candidates who contested the pool. What they perhaps may have thought that the SLPP is divided, we showcased to them yesterday that we are not divided. We are a democratic party that can disagree to agree, and we are able to disagree to a point that we are able to address all the doubts and issues we had in mind before we got to the conference. So we will say to our opponents that, in fact, it's enough for them to know that SLPP is clinching victory, especially so that we believe that democracy gives power to the people. And we allowed our people to make the decision and not we making the decision for them. And so the fact that they made the decision and they gave us the candidate they want, it is very obvious that the candidate they have given us, we clinched the victory. We are talking of us a candidate that has served this country in a very difficult and defining moment at a tender age and was able to make a very responsible decision for this country. And he initiated the peace process in this country, and he also spearheaded the democratic transition from military rule to civilian rule. And a lot of people in our country remember that, and they want to pay him back for that. And so, given the fact that the people have given him to us as their choice of candidate, it is very clear that we will have, without the Julius Maada Bill emerge, the winner of the 2018 polls. So the 2018 poll, we are very much confident, even though we are not complacent, though, but we are confident of the fact that doing our homework well, we will win the election at the first ballot.
Lahai Lawrence Lehman is the National Publicity Secretary of the Sierra Leone People's Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 17th. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. The death toll in last weekend's explosion in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, has risen to more than 300 as rescue teams continue to search for survivors from the massive explosion that has been blamed on Islamist militants. Dr. Abdul Kadir Adam, head of Mogadishu Ambulance Services, told VOA Somali Service that 302 people are confirmed dead from the blast, which struck a busy intersection in the Somali capital late Saturday. The government says 429 injured people have been taken to local hospitals and that the death toll is likely to rise. More than 30 badly wounded patients were flown to Turkey on Monday for treatment, including VOA Somali reporter Abdul Kadir Mohamed Abdul.
Right now, the number of deaths is 302, and the number of injured is more than 400.
And are there people still missing?
Yeah, there's a lot of people missing. They are under the collapsed hotels or buildings. We don't have, you know, a well-trained rescue team. We don't have the rescue material. So I don't think that the people will remain alive.
Tell us about the situation and the condition of the people you rescued.
The people we rescued have different types of injury. They have very big injuries like head injury, abdominal injury. Some of them, the limbs are missing, either hand or leg. And some of them are paralyzed. And I don't think that most of them can be treated in Somalia. I don't think.
So what kind of injury did the victims sustain?
Very small number has a simple injury. But most of them, they have very big injuries, which is possible to die or to have, you know, some impact in their life.
What kind of injuries?
There is, you know, a head injury, spinal cord injury, missing hand or leg, some of their organs. They have a trauma morally and mentally and physically as well.
Tell us about the scene where the explosion took place. When you went there, what did you see?
In 10 years' experience of working in emergency, I have never seen such an explosion. It was very strong, very heavy explosion. When we reached there, we have seen a lot of people bleeding, crying, dead body, parts of the body lying over there, many cars burning, some hotels and buildings collapsing. We have seen so upset, you know, things.
Can you explain to me exactly how this explosion was different from previous explosions?
This was extremely different from the other we have seen before. When you come to the injury people, the number is small, the injury is difficult to be treated, the dead people are more, and you cannot recognize whether this person is your family or not because they burn all of them, the colors change. The limbs are missing. When it comes to the magnitude of the explosion, was very heavy, very strong, and it has, you know, some economically and life loss.
And what are the most urgent basic things that your service needs?
We need well-equipped ambulance which can be saving the lives. We need also for communication, radio space, or, you know, walkie-talks, which we can coordinate ambulance and health sectors. Moreover, we need a training.
Dr. Abdulkadir Adam is head of Mogadishu Ambulance Services. He spoke with reporter Harun Maruf of the Somali Service. Members of South Sudan's National Dialogue Steering Committee say they fear fighting will continue across the country after former First Vice President Riek Machar refused to meet with them in South Africa over the weekend. This was the second time Machar had refused to meet with the group. As Tito Justin reports from Juba, one of the delegation members says it will be difficult to end hostilities in South Sudan unless Machar is involved in the national dialogue.
About 20 members of the National Dialogue Steering Committee and Secretariat returned to Juba over the weekend after failing to meet with Machar. South Sudan in Focus tried to reach Machar and his advisor several times last week without success. Angelo Beda, co-chairperson of the National Dialogue Steering Committee, says Machar declined to meet his group.
I think the reason is that he prefers a revitalization of the peace agreement to national dialogue. And we have said again and again, you can join it and you can send your people here. And that one, if it succeeds, we want to stop the war in southern Sudan. That is our immediate aim, which is the same aim of the revitalization.
After fighting erupted last July between Machar's forces and government forces, Machar fled the capital. In the interim, Machar has repeatedly called for the review of security and power-sharing arrangements and has expressed support for revitalizing the IGAD brokered August 2015 peace agreement. Betty Achan Aguero, deputy co-chair of the National Dialogue Steering Committee, says Machar's repeated refusal to meet with her team will only prolong the country's ongoing war.
The impact we can see is his supporters may continue to fight while we are actually fighting to stop the violence. So one reason why we wanted Dr. Riek to meet the team is to express himself. Because once he expresses himself, this will be known to everybody why he is not happy. But when he doesn't express himself and his supporters outside continue to fight, this, of course, will prevent us from reaching areas that we want to reach.
In May, President Salva Kiir ordered all government forces to cease fire to create an atmosphere conducive for holding a national dialogue, but the fighting did not stop. Lual Achwek, a member of the National Dialogue Secretariat, warns it will be impossible to restore peace in South Sudan unless Machar participates in the dialogue.
How do you stop the cessation of hostilities if you are not talking? So the process and experiences from other countries is when all people come together and they agree on the steps what need to be done. So Dr. Riek has to be on board first in order to stop the cessation of hostilities.
Despite Machar's refusal to meet with the steering committee, Beda says committee members will continue to meet with the other groups to convince Machar and other armed groups that it's their best interest to take part in the dialogue. In June, foreign envoys in South Sudan said they would fund the proposed national dialogue on condition that the government first ends the fighting. Beda says the steering committee will not give up on its effort until the objectives of restoring peace and stability across South Sudan are met. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Efforts are underway to modernize Kenya's agriculture sector after a significant drop in farmers' earnings last year. Drought and an invasive insect known as fall armyworm played a big role, but poor seed varieties and lack of equipment like tractors are also persistent problems. Lenny Ruvaga reports.
John Miner, a farmer in Thika, about 45 kilometers from Kenya's capital, Nairobi, is about to begin plowing his one-hectare farm in preparation for the planting season. But before he can do this, he ensures that the tractor is in working condition. For the past year, Miner has turned to mechanized farming courtesy of an app known as Tinga, which when translated from Swahili means tractor. In the past, Miner would farm using manual labor, which according to him was both time-consuming and costly.
Using the tractor has been really good and efficient. Before, when I used to hire workers to till manually, it would take up to 3 days. But using a tractor, one can take only 2 hours, and the harvests are much better.
Tinga was developed 2 years ago by Kenyan app developers to help farmers get access to tractors at a fraction of its cost. Tinga operations manager Ken Mwangi notes that in 1 month, some 1,000 farmers used the services offered by Tinga. The app can be found on the Google Play Store, and by following a few simple steps through a series of prompts, the farmers can schedule a tractor at the time of their choosing. Plowing a hectare of land costs an average of $30. According to Mwangi, this has encouraged farmers countrywide to turn to mechanized farming. However, Mwangi says that there are challenges with literacy and access to smartphones.
Most of our farmers don't have smartphones. This has led to a situation where they cannot be able to request for our services. However, we have mitigated against this by providing our farmers with a text message number that they can use to also request the same services on SMS.
Tay Mukunya, the CEO of Azuri, began the health food manufacturing company 7 years ago to encourage a healthy lifestyle through nutrition. Azuri indirectly employs about 5,000 farmers who supply raw materials for the company's product range. According to the Kenya National Bureau of Statistics, KNBS, the number of farmers in the country who earned more than $1,000 dropped in the past year. Mukunya says that diversifying her products has meant that farmers have a stable income source.
Farmers in Kenya are small-scale farmers, so they grow very many products. So the wider the product range we have, it means that we're able to take more from the farmers. So we pick bananas, we pick beans, we pick maize, we pick mangoes, we pick all sorts of products, which then you find will be the same pool of farmers. It really boosts their income in that way.
For smallholder farmers such as Minor, the decision to mechanize his farming methods, along with the relative affordability of farming machinery, has meant that his yield has steadily risen each time he harvests. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
This month, a website was launched aimed at highlighting literary contributions from black writers in Portuguese Africa. Writer Yovanka Porquet Pediagao is the founder of Terra Cruella. She spoke to Ricky Stryak about why she founded the new publication.
When people were putting events, panels, or initiating discussions, or, you know, literary platforms, there was really a lack of a perspective from Portuguese African writers, and so I felt that I wasn't seeing myself being represented, and I felt that it's very important and worthwhile as well, because I think there's really great writing coming from Mozambique, São Tomé, Guinea-Bissau, Cape Verde, and Angola. So I decided I'd create my own platform in order to showcase it.
Are you guys going to make it accessible to people who are not Lusophone?
Yes. So we put out a call for submissions. We're asking for submissions either in Portuguese or in English. We also accept any other African languages such as Criollo, provided that people can provide a translation in Portuguese or English. So all the pieces will be translated into English in order for other people to also, for it to be accessible to others, basically.
That's really cool. And I think, obviously, this is part of the reason behind it too, but a lot of people don't seem to know about Lusophone Africa. And it's been my experience that it's a lot to do with the language barrier, actually, more than a lack of interest.
Yes, there's a big the barrier is basically the language issue, and this is why I'm making it also accessible in English and created this platform, because I also believe that my public is not necessarily people that speak French, English, or Portuguese. It's more towards other Africans, because I believe that African literature should be a talk between different countries, so within Africa, if you see what I mean.
As writer Yovanka Porquet Pediagao is founder of Terra Cruella, a website highlighting literary contribution from black writers in Portuguese Africa. She spoke with Ricky Stryak from London. And that is it for this Tuesday, October 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotin and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you in Africa a good day.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
voaafrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
All day, all night.